Real families, real farms, real food. Welcome to Arizona Agriculture Connection with Maricopa County Farm Bureau. My name is Nicole Clements, Executive Director, and I'll be your host. Maricopa County Farm Bureau is the voice of agriculture in a community that thrives on the dichotomy of urban and rural agriculture operations. This podcast is a home for farmers, ranchers, food lovers, prospective agriculturalists, and those looking to connect the food on their plate with the farm that it came from. As we take an inside look at agriculture in Arizona, we will delve into topics like ag technology, policy, food preparation, and everything in between. You can find us on your favorite podcast platform with new episodes every Wednesday. Arizona Agriculture Connection is hosted by Maricopa County Farm Bureau and sponsored by Paloma Ready Mix and Materials, a proud supporter of agriculture and our communities. Be sure to subscribe and share your favorite episodes with your friends. For more interactions, follow us on social media, Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn, at Maricopa County FB. Now let's discover some Arizona agriculture. All right, friends, welcome back to Arizona Agriculture Connection. My name is Nicole Clements, Executive Director, Maricopa County Farm Bureau, and I will be your host. Today, I am here with Eric Wilkie, CEO of Arizona Grain, and we're going to be talking everything tariffs and exports and how that relates to agriculture and to the consumers on the shelves. So welcome, Eric.
Yeah, it's good to be here and to do this. It's obviously a very relevant topic. It's been headline news every minute, changing by the second. So look forward to this discussion.
It's definitely been a hot button topic lately. So it's opportune timing, I think. So tell us a little bit about your background, about your history, and how you ended up here in Arizona.
Yeah, so I grew up on a farm, a grain farm in Illinois. And during the late 70s and 80s, farming was obviously a challenge. Farming is always a challenge, as everybody and your listeners know. I went to the University of Illinois, came out of that experience with the desire to farm with my family. However, 21% interest rates made that really practically impossible. So I decided to use my degree, which was in commodity markets and having a degree in economics, and get into the agriculture world, but from the market side. So I went to work for Continental Grain Company, which was one of the international grain companies, kind of the ABCs is what they're called, or the Seven Sisters, what sometimes they were referred to. They were basically international grain trading companies. Took a job in South Dakota and then on to Minneapolis, developed skills in futures trading and also in the export markets, exporting spring wheat and high protein wheats around the world, including durum wheat, and then went out to Portland, Oregon with Continental and traded the Asian markets, Japan, Taiwan, Korea. Those markets also engage in international trade in that regard. From there, I had made a connection with the folks at Arizona Grain, trading wheat from Arizona as part of the deck I traded with Continental in the export markets. And one thing led to another, and I got the opportunity to come down here. I thought it would be a kind of a mini MBA program instead of going back to the university to get an MBA, and that's what it proved. The other thing it proved was my plan of 5 years and then I'd go look to do something else changed. So I've been here for 35 years this year. So Arizona's become my permanent home and a place that I love.
I think as a fellow Midwest transplant to Arizona, I think I won't be leaving anytime soon. So
yeah, we had, I think the late John McCain told people, but he also, I was in the room when he said it. He says, when I go around the world, I only meet three kinds of people. He said, the people that live in Arizona, the people that have family in Arizona, and the people who are moving to Arizona. And I thought that was probably accurate because I know a lot of my family have followed and either visit or have now moved here. It's a great state.
Yeah, I think we're now the hot spot for family vacations. So
exactly.
So with all this extensive experience in the export market, can you speak to why export markets are so important for American agriculture?
Yeah, I mean, export market is a segment of a market. And, you know, you need all the components of a market to absorb the supply. It's an additional part of demand. So if you have a market, let's say for wheat, if you didn't have an export market, then you would dramatically change the demand for wheat, and it would make for less price discovery. It would make for a less balanced market. And, you know, ultimately you would find that, you know, farmers that grow wheat would not have a significant demand for their product. So where we produce surpluses, export markets are where we take those surpluses. And that's where the final bushel of wheat or the final ton of wheat gets priced, which sets the overall tone in the market. So export markets are very important for price discovery and ultimately balance of supply and demand.
I think when you look at it from a consumer perspective, a lot of times they want to see us not producing for other countries. Let's focus on American people with American-grown food. But finding out that these export markets are actual necessary tools that we have to be able to continue producing and continue to have a profitable farming operation, that it's a key component to what we do. And I think that's lost in translation from farmer to market to consumer a lot of times.
I think you're exactly right. If we only produced, say, wheat, and wheat is not one of our, wheat is, I think, in the top 8 exports of all of U.S. ag products. 7, 8, depends on the year, depends on prices, things like that. But soybeans are number 1, corn are number 2, beef is number 3, and we can go down the list. Wheat is in that 6 or 7 range. But if we didn't export wheat, for instance, we would have such an over surplus that farming and growing wheat, even for our domestic market, would not necessarily be practical. There would have to be a big reallocation of resources. Farms would have to look for other crops that were suitable for their area. For instance, Western Kansas. Kansas is the largest wheat producing state. And if you went to Western Kansas and said, hey, we don't need that extra wheat that's produced here, there aren't very many good alternatives in that area. Wheat is well adapted to that environment. So if you took away the export market, you take away their opportunity to grow a crop. Farming would become impractical. A great deal of that land would have to be set aside and therefore unproductive. And when you think about that, you know, if you're in a third world country, that excess wheat that the U.S. has and has available sets the tone also in the world. Even if they don't buy wheat from the United States, it's part of the world supply. And if you remove part of the world supply, you raise prices. So those people who are disadvantaged or don't have the resources and the income would then pay a higher price. And that only shortens the amount of, reduces the amount of food that they have available. So again, where you have productive lands, where you have an allocation of resources, export markets, and growing for a bigger market than just the United States is important. Plus, one more thing I think you'd add is we know about droughts in this country and around the world, and we know about bumper crops and things like that. Well, if you only grew for the United States and grew exactly the right amount, you'd have to know exactly what the weather is. Otherwise, you'd come up short. So that's another role that those export markets play, is that if we have a surplus, we export more. If we have a shortage, we export less. But we still have full use of the crop. It just decides, we just decide where it goes. So it's quite impractical. Because it's not a factory where you turn on the switch and we produce 747,000 widgets. We don't know what we're going to produce. And that's why we have a stocks and a carryover, which helps balance supply and demand. So I would say weather is one of those wild cards. You know, you could even say government activity. There's so many things that can drive new innovation, could all of a sudden create a new demand. And if you didn't produce a surplus, well, how would you produce that new product? So again, it's really impractical. It's myopic. It's short-sighted to think you would only grow for your own demand. And somehow, if we export crops, you know, we're either being selfish or we're, you know, we've got other agendas in mind. So agriculture works in this country because we are very good at what we do. We can produce some of the highest outputs with the lowest inputs. And why would you want to take that away from the world? You know, you really want to use that abundance that we have to produce for the entire world. And it's a benefit to the entire world. So that's how I would answer that one.
I think it's seen a lot of media activity, specifically in Arizona, with alfalfa. You know, people want to know, why are we exporting alfalfa? And the reality is that we're only exporting a minute amount of the alfalfa that's grown in Arizona. One of our larger export items is actually wheat, and which is a lot of what you work with. And it actually, I think a lot of people don't know, goes to Italy, and they love Arizona durum wheat to make pasta.
That's right. It ebbs and flows from year to year. Arizona has this perfect environment, and that's one of the reasons that wheat farming is successful here. If you grow a durum crop, and that's the wheat that's used to make pasta, if you grow it in North Dakota, Montana, the two major production states for durum wheat, again, we talked about droughts and abundance and surpluses. The crop can vary as much as 50% on a yield basis. Could be as low as 20 bushels to the acre, as high as 45 bushels to the acre. You know, on 1 million acres, that's a lot of variance, right? One thing about the Arizona production is that because our environment is so steady, we have, you know, 300 plus days of sunshine, very predictable weather. Our farming is performed by irrigation instead of just reliant on specific period of wet weather and so forth. So We have very programmed. Also, because of our environment, we have very low disease pressure. So every acre we plant, virtually we harvest. If you're in North Dakota or Montana, you might have a 30% abandonment rate. And so one of our advantages are, again, very predictable production, very high quality. And then the kind of the unique thing we do in Arizona and the Imperial Valley of California, they're part of the same environment and so forth, is that we have developed, we as private plant breeding companies, also as public university breeding programs, we've developed specialized varieties that are suitable for the desert environment. So to maximize our environment, maximize the quality of the product that we sell. So it is the niche for the Southwest here to produce a durum crop that's prized for its high quality around the world.
I think that was kind of leading into one of my next questions. So, you know, corn, soybeans, and wheat are overall our country's largest three exports. Many people would say that we shouldn't be growing any of those three things in Arizona because of the climate. But as you stated, it's opportune for us to, because we can dial it in, right? So we can determine exactly how much water we're putting on this crop. We can be more precise and efficient with our inputs on these crops, and therefore we have more stable output coming from those acres. So those are kind of the benefits that we have in the growing season that we have. And then, you know, you can't beat 350 days of sunshine out of the year. Good for people, good for crops.
Yeah. So one of the things about, you know, this challenge about, well, why do we grow these crops and should we be growing these crops? Cotton. Should we grow cotton? Should we grow wheat? Should we grow alfalfa? Should we grow corn? I mean, Arizona actually has a very wide range of crops that are adopted to our environment. That gives us some resilience in the sense that if there's a good market for wheat or a good market for alfalfa, we do have some flexibility. But I would argue that maybe the way to look at this is that we are an ecosystem. In other words, we have a dairy industry, we have a cattle feeding industry, we have export markets, we have a vegetable market. Yuma, Arizona becomes the salad bowl of the United States, of North America for about 3 months of the year, right? Well, if you didn't have wheat production or a cereal grain crop, but wheat is the highest value one, so that's the one we use, it would make it a challenge to grow those abundant vegetables that we get out of the Yuma area. Because each of those crops, those vegetable crops, they need a rotation. In other words, placing vegetables on soil year in, year out, year in, year out, there's troubles with cross-contaminations of varieties and different things. You need to add material to the soil. Wheat crops do a wonderful job that has one of the most extensive root systems. So if you're going to add back to the soil, wheat is an excellent crop in an area where you're growing vegetables. Because if you think about it, in lots of cases, vegetables, you take a lot of the material off the field, like with other crops, but you don't put as much organic material back into the field. Wheat is a great and excellent way to do that. So if you say, I need a vegetable industry and we all can get behind that, then you should also understand that while it doesn't seem at one level that wheat is a practical crop to grow in Arizona, it's a necessary crop to grow in Arizona. And I think that's the thing we sometimes forget about. The other thing about is that if we have rotations, because in Arizona, we're growing a crop on these fields throughout the state almost every, well, there is a crop growing every month of the year. Some crops, you know, so we overlay our seasons and we're using that land very productively all year long. And I think that's, again, one of our strengths, but we also can, we're growing crops that, yes, you could go buy somewhere else and transport. But when you think about what are the impacts on the environment, is it really a net better benefit to grow corn here to feed to your dairy cows to produce milk or cheese or yogurt versus transporting it from the Midwest? You can argue it's really a balance of both. And I think that's the answer of why what appears to be crops that maybe don't seem to fit really fit if you understand the ecosystem that we operate in.
I think Arizona's agriculture landscape is so robust and people don't necessarily see it because you're driving down the highway. You get a half a second glance at the farm on the side of the road or the dairy or what have you. You don't get that full picture of why we have all that. We have over, I think, 280 commodities that come out of Arizona. And so how do we have those and why do we have those? Well, agriculture has been a part of Arizona's history forever. And if we continue, you know, to want to feed the population that's here, we have to continue growing it here. You know, Arizona doesn't want to become an importer of all of our food goods, because then at that point, you know, I don't know that we would be able to support a population they wouldn't afford to live here.
Yeah, I mean, some of the crops are necessary for the local production. Fluid milk, I think, is a good example. It's very expensive to move water or to move fluids, right? They're heavy. They're a commodity. In the case of commodity would be quotes around milk, for instance, milk from Wisconsin and milk in Arizona ultimately have the same makeup, right? But it's very, very expensive to move milk from production areas to consumption areas. We have 7 million plus people in Arizona. We need a fluid milk supply. So you're going to have dairy cows here. And if you're going to have dairy cows here, you're going to need alfalfa here, and you're going to need forages here. And so that's to your point. I think if we want to live here, we need some of those things. But the natural progression in Arizona will ultimately be that we will use our land and our resources, our water, for higher and higher value usage. Arizona's had a very strong water plan, really, you know, for 100 years. It's evolved. It's become a hot button issue. It's always being argued about. I mean, the old, you know, water's for fighting and whiskey's for drinking or whatever, you know, however it goes, the quote, but that's true. And you know, we see a lot of headlines about water. You know, I get asked a lot about, you know, are you guys out of water in Arizona? No, we're not out of water. We actually have a fairly abundant supply. It's where it is, how it's being used, that is the challenge. Farming was always the low value user. And as water prices have risen, which is part of the natural progression as we build cities and industries and where we use that water, then agriculture would have to pay a higher price or get more efficient. And a good example, I think when I came here in 1991, a wheat crop took over 3.5 acre feet. And so that's 3.5 feet of water over 1 acre to grow a wheat crop, 4 acres to 4.5 acres to grow a cotton crop. Today, we do it for much less than that. And it varies by area and style of irrigation and whether your fields are perfectly level or not level, whether you use drip systems or use flood irrigation or pivot irrigation, all the types. They do vary a little bit, but our water uses has dropped dramatically. Why is that? Because it's a valuable resource that farmers have to pay for. And as that price has gone up, they've become more and more efficient and better at using it, whether it's the crops they grow, those have been improved, or they've moved to more drought-tolerant crops, things like that. And the water is now, some of that water that was used in farming is now used in developments and cities and industry. So it's always been part of the plan, if you will. It's not easy. It's not painless. There's always a challenge. Is it priced right for the farmer versus the cities and things like that? And we have had a long-term drought, and there's no way to look away from that. But I think our water plan has been pretty coherent, even if you know, you see the battles at the, you know, at the legislature about water and, you know, whether or not we should be exporting water and things like that. I mean, that's a buzzword. And I'd love to talk a little bit more about that. You kind of alluded to it earlier about alfalfa and the argument that we export water. But again, water is a valuable resource. It's being allocated by the markets really very efficiently, even though we see the tug and pull of legislative action and gubernatorial, you know, decisions about water. But I'm confident that Arizona is going to have farming much longer than the headlines would lead you to believe. And it's because we have people and that need those crops to be grown locally, whether that's a dairy crop, quote, or an alfalfa crop to feed the dairy cows.
I would love for you to expand on that, because we've seen that so much in the headlines. We don't need to export water. And they're not talking about putting water in containers and shipping it. They're talking about growing crops and exporting those crops. And to me, feels very much like a buzzword, like a buzz phrase, right?
Right.
It captures a lot of attention, which is the goal. But what is the actual story behind it?
Yeah, I mean, so exporting water has kind of been villainized. I think the intent of farmers who grow alfalfa, particularly alfalfa that gets exported to places in the world that aren't so friendly. And in some cases, I think the target has been Saudi Arabia. There's been farms that have grown alfalfa that have exported forages to Saudi Arabia. They export, actually, those farms export alfalfa to a lot of places. Again, a pretty small amount of the alfalfa is actually exported. So that's been the villain. It was an easy target. It was a way to go after because, you know, I mean, sometimes the Saudi government or certain members of the Saudi royal family haven't been friendly to the United States, or we're not in sync with them. But the reality is, when we talk about exporting water, we export water with every crop we go, whether it's lemons, whether it's pistachios, whether it's vegetables from Yuma, going to New York City in the winter. I mean, New York's got a surplus of water. Why do they need? There's a bigger picture there. But we are using a valuable resource to grow a valuable crop to address a valuable market. And again, it's really, we export our sunshine. Does anybody complain that we export our sunshine? We grow these crops here because we have this abundance of sunshine. But because that's a, you don't have to pay for that asset, there seems to be an unlimited amount of it, then we don't argue about that. But every crop, if it's a seed in the ground, it uses water, and in some form, it's exported. Yes, there's consumption here. But again, as I talked about vegetables or alfalfa or durum wheat or corn or even dairy products, even if you milk a cow in Arizona, the water that went to sustain that cow or to feed that cow that produced the crop to feed the cow, that dry milk's going in an export market. So did we export water that way? I think so, if you want to follow the logic of we're exporting water. So I think that's just kind of, it's an easy target. It's a buzzword people don't really think through, or it's easy to be, you know, to just overlook it. I won't say they don't think through it, but they just overlook it because they're maybe not aware of how those resources are used. And because we have a finite supply of water in Arizona, it becomes very political or very easy to use as a political tool. But ultimately, we're very good stewards at how we use our water.
Yes, agreed. So let's maybe switch gears a little bit and get to a current hot topic. So tariffs, which have been on every news headline that I've seen over the last several weeks. So first of all, you know, what is a tariff? A tariff is a tax on imported or exported goods, right? So what impact will these potential tariffs that we're looking at with Canada and Mexico have on our farmers?
Yeah, I mean, we've all been looking at the lists of, or trying to find the list of products and find out what are the tariffs we're going to place on imports of products from other countries. How does that change the supply and demand of the crops that are important to Arizona? One, we're searching for the answers, and we know that, you know, in 5 minutes, it can all change, as we found out really yesterday between Mexico agreeing to certain things that the administration wanted to do in Canada, you know, then following suit a little bit later and agreeing to address some of the concerns. And so the tariffs may be off for a minute, but tariffs, yes, are a tax. And, you know, who pays them is also an interesting question, because it's not all, there's maybe three places they can be paid, or a combination, of course. And that is the consumer at, here in the United States, if there's a tariff placed on a Canadian import into the U.S., whether it be oil, whether it be wheat, whether it's other products that Canada, wood, lumber, that Canada may have a surplus, right? So it depends. If there's an alternative supply of equal value before the tariff goes on and a tariff starts, let's say on Canadian lumber, then the buyers and the consumers in the U.S. would not necessarily have to pay more, because they could go to the local supply. They could go to a U.S. supply for lumber, all right? So in that case, then, to be competitive, the Canadian lumber mill would have to absorb the tariff. So that's a case where the tariff gets absorbed on the exporter, in this case, the Canadian lumber company. Now, if there isn't an alternative source that's viable, let's say on that Canadian lumber, then the builders and ultimately the buyers of homes who are using that lumber will pay for it in their price of the home that they have built, because they've got to pay for that extra cost on that lumber, okay? If that's the case, if there wasn't another alternative or a surplus here in the United States from another source. And then there's a combination, maybe, is that over time, you know, in the short run, you can't create another source. You can't import lumber from another part of the world that doesn't have a tariff. And so sometimes you have to pay it for a while, and then you develop a market. Also, if you think about it, if a tariff goes on at 100% on Canada's lumber, and that's just, I'm just using it for an illustration, what's going to happen to the supply of U.S. lumber? Well, there's going to be a greater demand for it, so its price is going to rise to offset the tariff. So it's going to be a sharing, and the consumer is going to pay higher lumber prices. So tariffs aren't always clear who gets to pay them, and it really is, it's dynamic. You don't know, you might be able to tell today what the first impact is going to be, but over time, the markets are very efficient at finding alternatives and leveling that price field so that the tariff may be shared, the tariff may be pushed back to the seller, or the tariff may be absorbed by the buyer. And I think that's the disruptive part. Sometimes when a tariff, if the United States would put a tariff on Canada and Canada would retaliate, let's say, on certain products, we may get a benefit, though. I'm trying to think of an example where we may, but wheat would be a good example. Canada right now exports quite a bit of durum wheat into the U.S. for pasta production. Canada is one of the largest durum producers in the world, right? Which is, again, over 1 million tons of Canadian durum comes into the United States. So if the United States place a tariff on Canada's imports coming in with durum, that's going to raise the price for durum from the U.S. producer. So there's a benefit there. The Arizona farmer, the North Dakota farmer, the Montana farmer should see greater demand for their product because the mills can't buy Canadian or would see the prices rise. So again, very dynamic. I think there's going to be winners and losers in this tariff. If we go to tariffs as the final result of the changes that this administration wants to see on the border relative to immigration and fentanyl and some other things, there's going to be winners and losers in this. And our job is to figure out how, you know, we can keep markets fluid, keep the supply chain intact, look for alternative supplies and respond to these tariffs. And that's kind of the job of a company like ours is to look at markets and whether it's supply or demand or tariffs or otherwise, and arbitrage out those impacts so that we can pay the most, the logical to our producers, or supply at the most competitive price to our customers here in Arizona, whether that's a dairy or a feed yard or a poultry operation or a durum mill. So long answer, but again, it's really an ebb and flow. There's going to be winners and losers. These impacts are significant. When you start talking about 10 or 15%, you're talking about bigger moves in the market than we see, within a season typically, and they're all coming immediately. And that's what makes it very difficult. Markets don't like uncertainty. And if there was ever an example of uncertainty in markets, right now, these tariffs have put us in that position. And when you have that uncertainty, then we don't know what to do. I mean, consumer doesn't know what to do. A trading company doesn't know what to do. Exactly, right? Because we're trying to sort it out. And so things become very inefficient. Margins have to widen for the risk. And those create inefficient markets. And again, that's our job to sort that out. But that's where we are today. It's a very dynamic, uncomfortable place to be. We're looking for the certainty that, markets function well under, and that's how we'll proceed. It's kind of nice that for a moment, it seems like we've got a reprieve, but that gives us technically, a period of time to figure out a better way to absorb these impacts and to make adjustments. So long answer, but it's a big, complicated topic.
And I think from the consumer standpoint, a lot of the discourse that I've seen, mostly online, which is where a lot of people get their information and get their news from, is some people think and understand that it will be the consumer's pain in the end. Some people say that it's not. And I think the lawyer's favorite answer is it depends, right? Depends on the good. It depends on where it's coming from. It depends on a lot of other factors. And as we sit in this limbo type situation, now we're just kind of waiting to see, and we don't have any real answers at this point.
Yeah, exactly right. And markets don't like that. Consumers don't like that. And, like I say, so there's going to be some winners and some losers in this. But I think whenever you create inefficiencies in market or displacements, it's a burden on the system and it's less efficient. There has to be a reallocation of resources. I mean, we all have resources available and we're always trying to employ those resources, whether it's capital or our environment or our farm ground or our factory. How do we employ those assets efficiently? Well, this is shaking the ground and we now have to think about, okay, if these things happen, how do we reallocate those assets? And it's difficult to do quickly and efficiently. And that's, I think, the trade wars or an environment where there's a lot of ebb and flow with these tariffs finds us right now. It's just not an efficient way for markets to run. Sometimes necessary, tariffs can have a benefit. Tariffs have been used successfully in this country to support industries that are vital or important to us. It's a way to also, in some cases, manage foreign policy. When you want to affect the world, using a tariff one way or the other can be effective at changing behaviors, supporting allies, punishing enemies. So tariffs by themselves aren't a bad thing, but they can be used for good or for bad. Again, but the most significant thing is they're disruptive if they're immediate and with that and significant, and there's not time to adjust.
I think that kind of circles back to the reason that we do exports at all in the first place, right? So I can't remember where I heard it, but somebody said, food security is national security. And while we're growing the foods to sustain our country, we're also sustaining our place globally, which, like it or not, is important. And agriculture plays a big part of that. So for me as an agriculturalist, farmer at heart these days, but, you know, I'm proud that we're able to provide that. And I think we do a good job of providing for Americans and Arizonans and their food supply, but we can also, you know, lend a hand when it's needed elsewhere.
Absolutely. I mean, post-World War II, the food supply that the U.S. was able to send to Europe, you know, their systems had all been destroyed and really damaged, and until they could get themselves back up and become productive, our food surpluses were a huge world benefit, and it allowed us to have a different influence in the world. I think we all have a place in our hearts and minds where, you know, we need to use some of our surplus and abundance to help people in the world, and that's what our agriculture systems, which are super efficient and productive, have the ability to do. And with that food or food aid, or just being a major supplier, even if it's at a full market price with no support, is ultimately a valuable tool when it comes to being influential in the world in a positive way, or could be a negative way. But in my opinion, I mean, the United States has a long history and track record of using food not as a weapon, but as a way to build, you know, build people of the world up and give them an opportunity to stand on their own two feet. Sometimes they've needed some help. And also by exporting our surplus, we keep, you know, the burden of the food cost to feed a family in a remote land or different part of the world doable. If you took the excess surplus that we provide to the world markets and took it away, there'd be a lot of people that couldn't eat their next meal. So again, I think we have a role in the world to play. Agriculture has had his history of playing that role, and it's one that we shouldn't walk away from.
Agreed. Well, any final thoughts?
Well, Nicole, I am an optimist. I know being an economist, it's supposed to be considered the dismal science, but I think it's just the opposite. I look at the world optimistically because I think I come from agriculture, and you got to be an optimist to be in agriculture because you face so many challenges, all the environmental pressures and the adversity of weather and things like that. So if you didn't approach it with optimism, you wouldn't come to work the next day. But I think that's the story for Arizona's agriculture. I am bullish on Arizona agriculture. If you really understand what it is and how resilient it is and how widespread it is, even though we don't see it from our highways and roads, a lot of cases, I mean, that's, you alluded to that earlier. I know how many of my friends from the Midwest or from other parts of U.S. agriculture come as winter visitors, drive between Phoenix and Tucson and go, where is agriculture? It's not necessarily along the main arteries and highways, but as we know, living in rural communities, agriculture is everywhere and it's a vital part of this state and it will be a long time in the future. So again, I embrace people that sometimes think agriculture doesn't fit in Arizona or it doesn't have a future. I'd say get in your car and drive out and go meet a farmer and talk to him. I think you'll find that there is a lot of optimism out there. And I'm just been grateful to have had a career as being part of Arizona's agriculture community.
Very well put. So thank you today for your conversation. This information was outstanding, so I appreciate that.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Thank you. So catch us next week on Arizona Agriculture Connection for the Maricopa County Farm Bureau Ag Report. Thank you for tuning in today. And remember, Farm Bureau has a place for you. Be sure to subscribe, leave a review, and share this episode with your friends on socials. You can also visit our website, maricopacountyfb.org, for more information and to submit a topic you want to learn about. Remember to tune in every Wednesday wherever you listen to podcasts. A huge thank you to Paloma Ready Mix and Materials for supporting our agriculture producers and this podcast. Maricopa County Farm Bureau, bringing you the stories of real families, real farms, and real food. I'm Nicole Clements, signing off. Catch you next week.